coffee time in Shanghai, with a little less froth for a service sector where growth was at a four-month low in March. The latest PMI at 52.3, the weakest since November. It follows a softer manufacturing reading this week and stirs up concerns of a sharper-than-expected slowdown. Economists are sticking to forecasts the momentum will slow later this year as some of the glitter fades from China's property market. Rising borrowing costs could also cool output.
More details emerging Wednesday on the Iranian-born woman who had accused YouTube of discriminating against her and is suspected of opening fire at its California headquarters, wounding three people and killing herself. 39-year-old Naseem Aghdam, a resident of San Diego, frequently posted videos to YouTube on animal rights and veganism. Some of the posts in Persian and English show glimpses of anger at YouTube, which she alleged was filtering her channel and preventing it from getting views.
Malaysians were up in arms on Wednesday, defending the dignity of what some call the country's national dish. It's the aftermath of a MasterChef UK episode where a Malaysian-born chef was kicked off for her chicken rendang dish, which judges said wasn't crispy enough. Voices across Southeast Asia were quick to point out, if your rendang is crispy, you're doing it wrong. A floodgate also opened on social media, with Southeast Asians voicing their outrage on Twitter.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Thursday. It's April 5th and 5:10 in the morning. We are very glad you're here with us today for another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. A great show for you lined up this morning. A little bit later in the program, Richard Myrick is going to be here. He's the editor-in-chief of mobilecuisine.com. We're going to be talking about the business of food trucks. And in a minute, we'll bring in our thought leader. We have a new thought leader today. Wayne Janis is here, and we'll get our conversation going in just a moment. But first, let's hit the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Asian stock markets have rebounded from sharp losses triggered by escalating trade tensions between the world's two largest economies, the U.S. and China. Japan's Nikkei surged almost 1.5%. In South Korea, the market's up more than 1% as well. U.S. stocks finished higher yesterday after a sharp plunge in the previous session and after starting the day off nearly 500 points. At the end of the day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced about 1%, which really was a gain of about 800 points from the session low. The S&P 500 climbed 1.2%. The NASDAQ was up 1.5%. A couple of stories we're watching for you this morning. China's threat to raise tariffs on U.S. goods could be a disaster for American soybean farmers, but a boon to the Brazilian and Argentine competition. European aerospace companies, Japanese whiskey distillers also will likely win out if this continues. Regulators picked products China can get elsewhere when they made a $50 billion list, including soybeans and small aircraft, targeted for possible retaliation in a spiraling technology dispute with Washington. One economist says this should help minimize China's losses in the event President Trump goes ahead with planned tariff hike and Beijing responds. What we saw yesterday was a little bit of calming of the markets by the Trump administration. One of the leaders said yesterday that these are only proposals and nothing is set in stone yet, and that seemed to calm investors a little bit. A couple of other stories breaking this morning. Delta Airlines says a cyber attack may have exposed some of its customers' payment information. The cyber attack was apparently last fall. We're just now hearing about it now and hearing about how serious it is. The airline says the incident hit a chat services provider that Delta uses. Other companies use this as well. They think the information was exposed from September 26th to October 12th. Yesterday, Facebook says Cambridge Analytica data affected nearly twice as many users as previously thought. As many as 87 million users may have had their information improperly obtained and used. It is Thought Leader Thursday, and we're happy to have with us a new thought leader today. Wayne Janis is president of financial planning at Whitnell, an affiliate of Associated Bank. Wayne, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Morning.
It's good to have you. Wayne is with Whitnell, an affiliate of Associated Bank. He's one of our new thought leaders. I thought we would start a little first here out of the gate talking about your background a little bit.
Well, I graduated from DePaul University. I'm a CPA and an accountant, and I spent the first 10 years of my life in a Big Eight accounting firm, Arthur Young. So I got a master's in tax degree, and so I do mostly financial planning and tax advice and estate planning for the clients of the firm.
We are looking forward to our conversation with you because you're sort of the tax guru. I think that's an easy way of summarizing all of your experience, right?
I think I like to think of myself as a tax problem solver.
Yeah. Let's start with what people are doing right now, and that is they're getting ready to file their taxes. I've heard from a bunch of people that are, you know, putting things together for themselves that not enough money is being, or too much money is being taken out of their accounts, or not enough money after the tax bill. What should people be thinking about and looking at when they get into their taxes?
Are you talking about for last year or this year?
For the tax year that they're filing right now, so that would be last year. So
for 2017, all of these tax rules that were passed at the end of last year don't apply. So people are thinking about all these limitations. They don't really exist, except that the government did come up with one ruling that said that the advice that was given by a lot of professionals at the end of last year that you should prepay your real estate taxes, the government said, no, you can't deduct those. And so they'll challenge them on a return that you filed for last year. But for us, we live in Illinois, we have to understand that the taxes that were actually due to pay in 2018 are taxes that were assessed for 2017. So by prepaying those, you really haven't prepaid your 2018 taxes. You're paying the actual taxes that were assessed for 2017, and that's totally appropriate and legitimate to do.
But next year, that's when we need to pay more attention to that, when we file taxes next year.
Yeah, next year, it's a whole different ballgame because most of the itemized deductions have been eliminated. Most people that itemized, when I say most, more than half, will be claiming the standard deduction because of so many deductions that have been eliminated or have shrunk. For example, the real estate taxes and the state income tax, the limit is $10,000 in total. So if you paid $8,000 in real estate taxes and $9,000 in state income tax, that's $17,000. You can only deduct $10,000. Now, they're giving you a standard deduction of $24,000 if you're married. And so if your taxes are limited to $10,000, in order to even itemize, you got to come up with another $14,000 of deductions, mortgages and charitable contributions being the two most likely. But if you don't have a mortgage, if you rent a home, it's pretty hard to get to $24,000 of itemized deductions. Most people that rent are probably going to take the standard deduction.
We heard a lot about how we could perhaps do our taxes on a postcard. That didn't come to fruition, did it?
No, I mean, it's going to be easier for those people that used to have to find all their itemized deductions and figure out when they paid the charity and where, you know, what receipts they have. It means that most people will not have to do that. And the income side of it is usually pretty simple because you get a statement from a bank or a statement from a brokerage firm or your employer showing you what your income is. And so for most people, it will be much simpler. I wouldn't call it a postcard, but I would say it's a lot simpler.
And I guess what I was referring to earlier as we started our interview was at the end of, when you file your taxes this year, there's the worksheet you do for next year so that you know if enough withholding, if you're doing the right amount of withholding. And people have been telling me that that too much is being taken out and that they fear they're going to have to pay next year. How do we know if that's the right amount or not?
Well, you almost have to run the math because if especially if you're married and there's withholding coming from two different employers, the likelihood is, I've seen it in our own company, that based on the tables, the government is taking out probably more than is necessary to cover the taxes. And so that suggests that you'll end up with a refund, but if you're having a trouble paying your bills, it's going to be a little tricky.
And so I haven't had to do this in a while. So you go in and you just have your company withhold more, right?
Well, you can ask them to withhold more. They always do that. And you can also, if you think that they're withholding too much, you can claim more withholding allowances. You can file a Form W-4, and they can reduce your withholding based on claiming additional withholding allowances.
There had been all this discussion about in February and March is when most Americans would see whether or not they were impacted by this in terms of getting more in their take-home pay. Not a lot of folks were. I don't want to talk about the political nature of all of this, but that was a letdown for a lot of people that more wasn't taken out of their paychecks.
Yeah, I think that people were surprised by that. They thought that the result would be different. I thought they'd be paying, in some cases, more so because they're losing deductions. In some cases, they thought they'd be paying less because they're going to get deductions that they otherwise wouldn't have had. So it goes both ways because people that don't own a home didn't lose a real estate tax deduction and aren't worried about the mortgage interest being impacted by the law. They're probably just going to get more deductions. So the winners come out to be people that are renting that are most likely going to take the standard deduction.
In all of your experience, how would you describe what we saw happen with this tax bill? Lots of changes, watershed changes, a big deal.
I remember going through this because in the year-end planning for last year, lots of issues came up. You had the House version, the Senate version, and the actual law is over 500 pages long. And it didn't get finalized till December. And so if you're going to do any kind of planning, you had to deal with what was there then. And so we're kind of rushing around, a lot of articles written, and it was also difficult because there's a lot of issues with the language because the AICPA issued a letter to the Treasury, a 22-page letter, asking the Treasury to explain some of these terms that are in the law. So there's uncertainty about what it even means. So I think that stands today. We don't know what some of these provisions mean. They're asking for definitions. We're asking for how these things apply. A good example of that is that the law said that if you invest in real estate stocks, 20% of the dividends will now be tax-free starting in 2018. Well, the AICPA sent a letter to Treasury saying, well, if you get the dividends directly from a real estate company, we get the 20%. But what if you own the real estate stock in a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund? Do you get the 20% deduction there? Please tell us now because people are in that situation. They are receiving and we don't know the answer to that. But most people believe that because of the language of the law, taken literally, if you own the stock in a mutual fund versus an outright ownership, you don't get the 20%.
And I've actually heard talk, too, that on Capitol Hill, they're talking about having to go back in and make some changes to the law because it was worded in a way that it would not be able to just have a footnote put on it. You have to go in and change the whole law.
It's pretty common. Every time we've seen tax legislation over the years, within a year after that, there's a tax correction bill that comes out. And these are laws that were passed with adequate time to do the vetting, to have the law firms and accounting firms take a look at them and come up with better language and come up with a final version. This one was put together so quickly, there's probably an even greater need for them to come up with a tax correction bill that'll cover some of the things that are there. Addressing the 22-page letter from the AICPA to the IRS asking for guidance about how these things are to be interpreted.
Lots of questions probably going to be going to the IRS, too, as people sit down to do their taxes and kind of get into all of this. Is the IRS equipped to handle all of this, or are they short-staffed still?
They have been short-staffed, and because of the 500 pages of law, they have to come up with regulations and guidelines and rulings now. So there's more work, and the funding has not been increased to allow them to do that work. In fact, most people would consider this a good thing, that it's estimated that probably their ability to audit tax returns will drop by a third in the future because of the lack of staff and the amount of work that they've got to get done just to deal with these changes.
Somebody might hear that and say, well, maybe I can sneak something in and get past them. Probably not a good idea, is it?
No, not if you get caught.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
But, you know, people do sometimes like to play the audit lottery.
Yeah. You talked earlier about the real estate part of how homeowners might be impacted, but there's also the mortgage interest area. And I know this is, for those of us who don't have a lot of deductions, a key area. What are the changes as we move forward with mortgage deduction?
If you have a mortgage from last year, the interest on that mortgage is still deductible, and that was capped at $1 million. If you end up and if you refinance that mortgage this year and take another million in a new mortgage, that's still deductible if it replaces the $1 million mortgage from last year. So you still get the full deduction for the interest on that loan. If you take out a new loan, the amount that you can borrow that's tax deductible is $750,000. More importantly, a lot of people had home equity loans last year, and the law permitted you to deduct the interest on up to $100,000 of home equity loan. But that was repealed effectively, retroactively, because even if you took out that loan last year, any interest you pay on that home equity loan is now non-deductible by statute. Now, that needs to be clarified a little bit, because if you took out the home equity loan to buy a boat, to go on vacation, to pay for your kids' college tuition, then that interest is no longer deductible. If you took out that home equity loan of $100,000 and the total debt was less than $1 million and that home equity loan was used to improve your home, then the interest on that is deductible now. And if you took out a home equity loan today and the total was less than $750,000, the interest would be deductible if you used that money to improve your home. So a lot of people got that confused.
Yeah, that's good information right there, because I think a lot of people thought it went away completely.
Yes, they did.
And then the other part of that is you mentioned that the people taking out the refinances, that's probably good news to mortgage bankers, right? Because they thought maybe the refinances would dry up a little bit.
Well, it's critical, because a lot of people didn't take out 30-year mortgages. They took out adjustable-rate mortgages, and so when those come due, they want to shop around to get a better rate. And so if they didn't allow the replacement loan to be deductible, they'd be in bad shape, because they'd end up with a non-deductible loan. If they refinanced with another bank and just replace the existing mortgage. So it's good for the people that have mortgages. It's also good for the mortgage bankers.
And there was also a lot of talk about whether or not potential new buyers would be scared off of buying a new home because of some of this. We're not seeing that evidence from home sales.
No, the new homes numbers were down the last month, so we are seeing some of that nationally, but there are pockets where it's very, very strong and other pockets where it's weak. But it's you would expect, if you're not going to be able to deduct real estate taxes and mortgage interest on a large loan, that anything that costs you more, it's going to be fewer people will want to take the bite. So it'll have a propensity, I think, to cause more people to think about renting versus buying.
How does the tax law affect divorces? I know there's some provisions about alimony that could be quite significant.
Yes, a couple of changes too, because the two things that they did, one is they eliminated personal exemptions. So if you had four kids and they fight about who could claim them as an exemption, well, exemptions were repealed. So you don't have any exemptions for your children or even for yourself going forward. They replaced that with the child care credit, which is $2,000 per child. But that doesn't apply to children all the way through college. It stops the year that the child turns 17. And I have twin granddaughters that will be 17 this year, and my son's in the Air Force, and he has a family of seven. He will lose those credits this year because they turn 17 this year. If you're talking about a divorce situation, they'll be arguing about who gets to claim the credit as opposed to who gets the exemption. But the other part of this is, since they eliminated the alimony deduction prospectively, not retroactively, so if you are in a divorce situation and you're paying alimony, the alimony is deductible. If you get divorced this year, the alimony would not be deductible to the person paying it, nor would it be income to the person receiving it. So everybody would say, well, that's a boon to the person receiving it, because they're going to have more money. They don't have to pay tax on this money. But in general, the people that are paying alimony are the ones in a higher tax bracket. If you take a simple example, if I get divorced and I'm paying my ex $10,000 and I'm deducting it at 40%, maybe higher because of state tax, that it cost me $6,000. I pay 10, I save 40%. Now if I pay alimony, I pay 10, it cost me 10. Now my wife, who's a stay-at-home a spouse, doesn't have much income, so the $10,000 that she got, she would have paid $1,000 of tax on it. So now you're talking about I lose $4,000 of benefit. She saves $1,000. Where'd the other $3,000 go? Well, it went to the government.
Yeah.
And so the pot is smaller. So it may be that it's better for the person receiving it, but the person paying it's going to say, hey, wait a minute, paying you 10, it only cost me 6. I'm not going to pay you 10 now because it's still going to cost me 10.
Yeah.
So it's going to make divorces much more difficult because there's less money.
And probably more acrimonious, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. This week we learned that dividends, because of the tax bill, are at a record high, $109 billion in the first quarter. There are some tax rules about tax deductions where dividends are concerned, aren't there?
Tax deductions for dividends?
I think it's 20%.
I just spoke about that. In certain cases, the real estate stocks and others, any flow-through entities like oil companies that the master partnership, master limited partnerships that flow through the income, you get to get a 20% deduction for the dividends. But again, most people own those things inside of a mutual fund, so they may or may not get that 20% deduction. They have to own them outright to be sure. Otherwise, we're guessing.
This is fascinating because there's so much here that you have to be an expert on every page of this tax bill, don't you?
Well, you certainly ought to know the things that affect you. Or going forward, whether it's investing money or whether you work for a company and you have an option to defer your income or contribute to a 401k plan, you need to have an idea of what's going on because the law that got changed for individuals expires in 8 years. And we go back to what it was last year. So if you're making long-term decisions, they change. So, for example, if you have $1 million mortgage 8 years from now, it's deductible, not today.
Yeah.
And so, and this 20% deduction for dividends goes away. So there's a lot there, or if you defer your compensation, a lot of companies allow people to do that. What's the bracket going to be later? Because now the brackets are lower. Because what they've done is they've lowered the top federal tax bracket to 37%, but they also allowed you to go through lower brackets and have some of your income taxed at 10%, which last year would have been taxed at 15%. So most people that are earning money as wages or ordinary income will see lower taxes because of that. And so I would expect people have to think about the future because these things, they sunset, they end at the end of 8 years.
When we hear lawmakers say that they not only want to go in and fix some of the problems with it, but make these cuts permanent, would all of that stuff that you've just talked about become permanent instead of retiring in 8 years?
Well, they couldn't make it permanent because politically, in order for them to make them permanent, they needed 60 votes, and which means they had to get both parties to vote for the legislation. Mm-hmm. And so unless you could get some of the Democrats to vote for the Republican version, it couldn't have passed. They had to keep the deficits at a certain level.
Right, right, yeah.
And so that's why they had to make these things temporary, so they didn't have to count that against their budget deficits.
You know, as I sit here listening to our conversation, I've never hired a tax person, but I'm thinking that it might be worth my while to do that. But other people are out there listening, saying the same thing, maybe once. Good advice is probably in order here.
I think having somebody do it at least as a checkup, looking at things and talking about what you're doing and getting a feel for, am I doing the right things? Am I taking advantage of what I can under this law? What can I be doing now? If I no longer can itemize my deductions because I can't come up with $24,000, I can only come up with $22,000 of deductions between my charitable contributions and my mortgage interest and my taxes, what can I do? For some people who do give money to charity, what I've been telling a lot of them is you should be thinking about prepaying those deductions because it would be worth your while to get over the $24,000 number in 1 year by doubling up or tripling up your charitable contributions, and the following year just use that money that's been put into your charitable fund to pay off the charity in the future years and take the standard. So every other year you take the standard, every other year you itemize, you get free deductions by doing that. simple example. I have a client that has 22,000 of deductions and 8,000 of which are charitable contributions. So he's going to take the standard. But I said, look, if you prepay the $8,000 this year and add it to your 22, you're at 30,000, you'll deduct 6,000. And had you made that $8,000 deduction in 2019, you wouldn't get any tax benefit. So you picked up $6,000 of extra deductions by prepaying. So it's some real money on the table for people that have the opportunity to bunch these deductions. And there's different kinds of items like medical expenses that could be bunched in certain cases. And people have investment loans. That's another one where people can come up with a way to bunch up interest expense in a particular year that will allow them to get some free deductions from having a standard deduction 1 year and taking the itemized deductions in another year.
Wayne, great conversation. I have a feeling that as a thought leader, you're going to save us a lot of money.
That's what, you know, people don't go to a tax accountant just to put the numbers on the form. That's what they hope for them to do, to figure out, am I doing things the right way? Am I leaving money on the table?
Yeah.
And not just currently, but long term. Well, you know, what's the future going to hold? Should I be doing more in the 401k plan? Should I be taking bigger deductions? Yeah, it's critical for people to just understand their own situation. And it doesn't mean you have to get into a lot of elaborate planning. It just means you have to understand your own situation better.
Well, these are all the topics and subjects that we will cover in the weeks ahead, and we look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Wayne Janis is the president of financial planning at Whitnell, an affiliate of Associated Bank. We're going to continue our conversation with Wayne after the bell and post it in a podcast of the opening bell later this morning at WGNradio.com. And you can hear more of our thought leader conversations there on our opening bell page and at AssociatedBank.com/thought leadership. And make sure you follow Associated Bank at Associated Biz on Twitter.
Hi, this is Jim Dahlke with today's InnoMinute on WGN Radio, a rundown of all the Chicago innovation and tech news you need to know, delivered by ChicagoInno.com. Illinois universities are producing more startups than ever before. Students and faculty at Illinois universities founded 942 startups in the last 5 years, which is the largest volume of startup activity the state has seen, according to a report. 81% of those startups are still in Illinois today. Chicago startup Grow It has created a platform to help gardeners source plants from retailers right in their neighborhood. The startup has built a mobile app where users can browse inventories of local nurseries and garden shops and connect with other growers by sharing pictures of plants and other gardening tips. That's today's InnoMinute from WGN Radio. Learn more at ChicagoInno.com and sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Thursday edition. Our next guest began researching how to start a mobile hot dog cart in Chicago and found there was a real void for information about mobile cuisine, food trucks, and the like. So he started Mobile Cuisine Magazine. The editor-in-chief of MobileCuisine.com, Richard Myrick, is with us this morning here in the opening bell. Richard, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being with us today. We should tell people, by the way, the website is mobile-cuisine.com, but you can find it at Mobile Cuisine on Twitter. The stories like applying four walls marketing principles to your food truck, are you ready for growth, are you doing Instagram the right way for your food truck? All of these are important topics for food truck operators, aren't they?
Absolutely. Every food truck is a small business, and the majority of them are being run by people who may not have always had small business entrepreneurship in their background. So Mobile Cuisine provides that link to helping educate vendors and how to improve their business.
You started all this, as I mentioned, because you were going to start your own mobile hot dog cart here in Chicago. There really is no training for any of this, you found, is there?
No, there really wasn't. At the time, this was at the heart of the recession, and I'm an architect by trade, and I was just trying to find an alternative route for some revenue in this city. And I started digging and digging and digging, and there was really nothing online to teach someone how to do it. So, you know, even back in 2010, finding a void on the internet was rare, so I took it and ran.
Flash forward to now, what's the landscape like? I know lots of cities have vibrant food on the street. How would you describe it?
Oh, it's still exponential growth. Technically, we're still less than 10 years into the growth of this industry. There were food trucks back in the 70s in Los Angeles and carts in New York, but the gourmet food truck industry really started happening in 2008 out in Los Angeles, and it's grown ever since. And to be honest, the only city that I've really seen backtrack on the growth of the industry is Chicago.
Really? And so why is that, do you think?
Overregulation. Overregulation and government, I'll come out and say it, government officials who are standing in the way of growth of the industry.
And that can be seen in a number of ways. I know we've talked to folks here in the show before and in our news segments about how, you know, they can't park on this corner, they can't go to that neighborhood, those sorts of restrictions too. Is that specifically what we're talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the Loop in general, which is where the foot traffic would be for a food truck to operate, food trucks have availability of about 3% of the parking available in the Loop.
I know that for those of us who love going to food trucks, we know exactly where to go, but I can't imagine having these in more places across the city. What needs to come, do you think, from City Hall in this regard? What's going to change their minds?
I think you have to stop looking at food trucks as competition to restaurants. Food trucks are providing growth not only to the mobile food industry, but to the restaurant industry. Street food has become a trend that I don't see going away anytime soon. And if you start looking at it as a partner in the growth of the culinary scene in Chicago, which is already vibrant. Don't get me wrong. I loved living in Chicago, but being there and seeing food trucks looked at as a scourge by many of the people who were creating the laws at the time, it does not help. And you can see that simply by the number of food trucks that started and have closed because the regulations were too overbearing on keeping their business open.
The city's Small Business Center is trying to change this, I think. Some people think that there's positive vibes coming out of that department. There are food fests, food truck fests now going on where they're sort of promoting, City Hall's promoting these trucks, and they're moving in different locations. I know we have one here on Pioneer Court near Tribune Tower. Is that the kind of thing that's going to break down the dam?
To be honest, I think that the biggest thing that will open up the floodgates would be to cut the 200-foot restriction from any food seller. I mean, when a food truck can't park within 200 feet of a restaurant or a Starbucks or a 7-Eleven, you've gone too far. I mean, the city didn't restrict Redbox from coming into the city to save Starbucks or to save Blockbuster. It's just the laws are in place instead of being for public safety and health. They're in place to protect the restaurant industry.
Just generally, from your point of view nationally, widen this out a little bit of attention to other cities. What would be, you mentioned Los Angeles, what would be another city that's doing it the right way?
Oh, some of the top cities where the growth is not stopping, you're probably looking at Austin, Texas, Portland, Oregon, Houston and Dallas, Texas, some of the northern tier cities in Florida. Southern Florida is a bit of a problem because the trucks can't bend on the streets at all. They can only go to event-driven locations. But I mean, Des Moines, Iowa is actually becoming a bustling food truck city.
That's awesome. Let me ask you this, Richard. I know the title of your site is Mobile Cuisine, and I love that because this really is more than food. I know I've had a chance to sample stuff that is cuisine. I feel like it's cuisine. It's given me a chance to sample restaurants that I never would have been able to get into or have the time to go to. There are some really good chefs behind these trucks, aren't there?
Absolutely. I mean, Washington, D.C., you've got some of the top names, Los Angeles. And here's the big thing. If a lot of these trucks are chef driven. And that's where Mobile Cuisine comes into play, because we do help them on the business side of things. But when it comes to the cooking, the Tamale Spaceship, one of the best trucks in Chicago, their team started up in Frontera. So you're seeing the quality of food is not something that it's just mom and pop's recipes that they're taking. It's they've been trained within the world, and to be honest, that's why the industry started the way it did. During the recession, a lot of restaurants were closing down, and there were a lot of chefs out of work. The best way for them to get into business wasn't necessarily to open a restaurant at $250,000 minimum. It was to be able to open a food truck for under $40,000 at the time.
You know, yesterday here on this show, we were talking about restaurant real estate, how expensive it has become in Chicago, how hard it is to find the right location. These food trucks seem to answer that, are the solution to that problem.
Absolutely. And to be honest, restaurants around the country are seeing this, and they're able to purchase their own food trucks and expand their brand by simply going out into different neighborhoods that before they would just be trying to do test marketing. Now they're literally able to go onto the corners where they'd like to operate and see what the foot traffic and how their brand delivers in those specific areas.
Richard, we're running out of time, but I want to just sort of ask a general question about how the industry is doing. Can you make money and make a living doing these food trucks these days?
Absolutely. You put the time and effort into it, and you continue to work. Absolutely. It's a money-making business. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme, but if you put time and effort into it, you can absolutely make a living running a food truck.
Well, I'm a big fan of your site and on Twitter as well, and one of the great things about it is you have a list. People can go now and vote for all of their favorite food trucks of the year. And I've actually put this list in my wallet, so when I go to these cities, I'm going to start looking up these different food trucks, Miss Chizo's in Miami, the Peach Tortilla in Austin, Sweets and Meats in Cincinnati, Ohio. All of these sound so delicious.
Absolutely. And one thing with this contest, this is actually food truck restaurants, which are the actual restaurants that have been started up by food truck owners. So it's not only is it just food trucks, but it's showing the growth of the industry, that they've been able to transform their brand from a rolling restaurant into a brick and mortar location.
Well, Richard, wonderful talking with you. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Anytime, let me know, and I'll be there.
All right, Richard Demirik, editor-in-chief of mobilecuisine.com. That's mobile-cuisine.com. And make sure you follow on Twitter at Mobile Cuisine.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, Dow futures up about 42 points this morning. NASDAQ futures up 34. S&P futures up 9. Now agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Some interesting reaction in the agricultural commodity market yesterday on the China-U.S. trade disagreement. At the Mercantile Exchange, live cattle closed higher after bargain buying reversed earlier losses following China's proposed tariff increases on U.S. beef. China listed beef and other U.S. goods that may incur a 25% duty by the end of May. So what did the cattle market do? Well, the June live cattle market up $2.90 a hundredweight ending the day at $102.52. And the April feeder cattle contract up $4.10 a hundredweight, closing at $134.62. And even the hog market increased. June live hogs up $1.65 at $73.30 a hundredweight. A different story, though, in the grain market at the Chicago Board of Trade, particularly in the soybean market. Definitely a reaction there to the China-U.S. trade situation. The July soybean contract down 22¾ cents a bushel at 1026½. It did come off its lows, but still sharply lower. Meanwhile, July corn down 7½ at 389¾. July wheat down 0.75 cents at 473¼. But it remains to be seen on where the markets in agriculture will move following the trade situation with China. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for Thursday, April 5th. The Commerce Department reports on the U.S. trade gap for February. Also, the mortgage company Freddie Mac reports on this week's average mortgage rates. A money supply report later. Treasury strips as well. The Fed balance sheet later as well. Bloomberg Consumer Comfort Index is due out as well today. Tomorrow we get the big jobs report and consumer credit coming in terms of economic and jobs and business reports.